Hey, you guys, Flickers of Fear, once again, my humble little movie review show. Movie we're talking about today, this was a cool one. I really, really like this movie, but I am going to say that this is one of those ones that you're either going to vibe with it or you're not going to vibe with it. It seems like it's very, very divisive. I did see a lot of reviews of this. This seemed like it was very, very critically popular. You know, like a lot of critics really seemed to love it. Some audiences really, really hated it. And I get that. But as I said, this is one that's either going to vibe with you or it's not. Just personally for me, this movie vibed with me like a motherfucker. It was just kind of like every single thing I like about movies was in this movie. So I just like couldn't believe, I was like, oh my God, it almost seemed like this movie was made for like me specifically, which is crazy. So this movie is called In Fabric. It came out in 2018, although I think it wasn't released in the US until a year later. And it's a British film. I had been seeing it turn up on all these kind of like best of 2019 lists, and the premise of it sounded really intriguing in the sense that they're like, well, it's kind of like a giallo-infused Eurotrash kind of movie about a haunted dress. And I was just kind of like, that sounds like something I need to investigate. So I'd been wanting to see it for a really long time, so I finally got around to watching it. And prior to watching it, I was not aware that this was actually written and directed by Peter Strickland, who also wrote and directed Barbarian Sound Studio, which I reviewed a while back, which is like a giallo homage, which I also really loved as well. That came out back in 2012. He's also done another movie called The Duke of Burgundy that came out in 2014. And that, again, is kind of like an homage to sort of those like old 60s and 70s like Eurosleaze type movies. And so that's definitely on my list as well, particularly because Barbarian Sound Studio was so great, and particularly because In Fabric, I mean, I adored this movie. I just thought it was amazing. But again, it's very arty. A24 is, you know, did it in the US, and it's very surreal. It's a black comedy, but the comedy, it's British, so it's kind of like the humor is just very, very dry, and some of it is almost kind of like cringe comedy kind of territory. So I kind of feel like one of the main criticisms that I saw of like a lot of people that really didn't like it, in particular like American reviewers or, you know, YouTubers or whoever, is they didn't really find it funny. So it is like a particular, you do have to have kind of like a particularly weird sense of humor. I actually thought it was, parts of it were quite hilarious, but as I said, it's not over the top. I think the Wikipedia page does actually call it a horror comedy, and I don't know, I kind of feel like when people say horror comedy, they usually mean like something zanier, kind of, you know what I mean? Like more like, you know, Tucker and Dale versus Evil, or even Shaun of the Dead or something like that. This is a much more dry, very, very dark, like morbid, witty kind of humor rather than overtly funny. You know what I mean? It's almost kind of like, and like I said, it almost has like cringe comedy, like the original British version of The Office, like type stuff where it's just these really awkward situations, and just like absurd, you know, just absurd situations in general. So there's that to it as well. This is a weird, weird movie. And coming from me, that's really saying something. But it's weird. It's bizarre. It doesn't really explain itself, but it doesn't really need to. I do kind of feel like a lot of people that saw this were just kind of like, well, I didn't really get it, like, or I didn't really know what was supposed to be going on. And honestly, I think it's better not knowing. I mean, I have some ideas about what was going on, but it's better not to know. I thought it was like better that it was just kind of this weird, like mysterious whatever, and you could kind of like draw your own conclusions. So the movie is kind of like, you know, comparisons to Suspiria, the original Dario Argento one, are inevitable. This is a very, it's not a giallo movie, and it's not even homaging a giallo movie, but the look of this is very giallo-esque. It has these really sumptuous, you know, kind of tactile, colors, and it's just kind of all this, you know, the sound design and all this other stuff. So it has that kind of thing to it. And it also kind of has that sort of like retro Eurosleaze sort of sensibility to it. But it's also kind of homaging British horror films, particularly the 60s and 70s, like in your Hammer films, your Amicus, like anthology films. It almost kind of seems like that. It has a tinge of maybe Black Mirror to it. And I've seen it kind of, you know, a lot of people say, oh, it's David Lynchian. It, in the sense that surreal it is, but it's not really like David Lynch at all. It kind of reminded me more of something like, I don't know, like Ken Russell or something like that. It's just a very, like I said, it's a very surrealist, nightmarish, but also like kind of funny, like funny slash unsettling. It's really, really hard to describe. It is a bizarre, bizarre film, but I fucking loved it. But I can see, as I said, that it's going to be very divisive because it's one of those movies that people are just kind of like, what was the point of it? I didn't know what the fuck was going on. It was style over substance, yada, yada. I've seen like a lot of different criticisms of it, but honestly, I loved it. And the more I think about it, I watched it early yesterday and I've been thinking about it the whole time. And I'm like, now I kind of want to watch it again. You know what I mean? And I was watching like another review of it and they said, yeah, like watch it a second time too, because it's even better then, because you can just kind of, because you already know that it's going to be like super bizarro. So it's just kind of like, you can just relax and kind of like let it wash over you. So I definitely think that I'm going to take that on board and I'm going to end up watching this again one day, because this is definitely one that I'm going to want to see again because I really, really liked it so much the first time. So what we have in this movie, let me see if I can kind of break this down for you a little bit. So we're introduced to our kind of main character, whose name is Sheila. She's played by Marianne Jean-Baptiste, who I've seen her in a lot of stuff, but I think she was like the most recognizable to me from Secrets and Lies, the Mike Leigh movie back in the 90s. And she actually got nominated for an Oscar for that. I don't think she won, but that's a great movie, by the way, if you haven't seen it. I love Mike Leigh. And, you know, so this, like I said, this is a very, very British movie. I mean, Peter Strickland is British and he's kind of seems particularly tuned into this specific sort of British absurdity, I guess. So, as I said, this is a very, very British film. So, Sheila, who's played by Marianne Jean-Baptiste, she has, her husband has left her. He's, like, run off with a younger woman, presumably. And she's kind of, like, left at home with her teenage son, who's kind of a dick, actually. You know, very dismissive of her. And the son has a girlfriend who is also very snotty and kind of like, she's always kind of like staying at their house and not really helping out with anything. She just seems like she's always kind of like bossing the mom around and just being really, I don't know, she's like really an asshole. So the two of them are in there. Poor Sheila is, you know, as I said, she's single and she seems like she hasn't really gotten over it. And she works in a bank, like as a bank teller. And it's bad enough that she just got divorced, that her son and his girlfriend are kind of taking over her house and being jerks. And then she works at the bank and like she has the two guys that like run the bank or the bank managers or whatever. They're called Stash and Clive. And they keep like bringing her into the office to, presumably, it seems like they're saying nice things like, oh, you're doing really well and blah, blah, blah. But then they start like excoriating her for like really, really weird, like minor shit. Like, you know, you spent 2 minutes too long in the bathroom before lunchtime and somebody was watching you and reported you. And then like later, like the criticisms that they make of her just get like weirder and weirder, like as the movie goes on. Like, you waved at the bank president's mistress in the street the other day and she reported that because she thought it was very, like, she was like, but she waved back and she was smiling. I don't understand. So it's just like this really weird, like absurdist, almost like a Kafka type of thing where they're just kind of showing how, you know, this corporation doing like all these nitpicky little things on her. So she's decided that she's kind of lonely, right? So she's going to go, she starts doing, this is, okay, the weird thing about this too is that I couldn't really get a handle on when this is supposed to be set. I don't think it's supposed to be set at any particular time because, like I said, I'm really continuity, like, you know, narrative focus wasn't really a main concern. It's definitely set at some time in the past, because judging by, you know, the answering machine, like on the phone and things like that, I kind of thought that it was maybe late 80s. I looked it up, and supposedly it's set in 1993. The weird thing about it, though, is that this movie is kind of like in two parts. It's one movie, but the narrative, like halfway through, like shifts to another main character. And that second part seems to be, considering like what people are wearing and things like that, it seems to be much later or much more recent, but it's supposed to have happened like very, very soon after the first part. So don't get too hung up about when is this supposed to be. It's the past. As I said, this is like a retro homage movie, so it's not too worried about when particularly, but it is just supposed to be sometime in the past. I thought late 80s, or it could be early 90s, I guess. Like I said, just compared to like what the technology was and, you know, the way the inside of the houses looked and stuff like that. So since there was no internet back then, when this movie is supposed to be set, Sheila decides that she is going to do like a Lonely Hearts type of thing, like in the newspaper. So they do this, and I remember this like in my own lifetime, but they used to have like these, you'd put in a classified ad and then everybody had like a box number, because, you know, you didn't want like weirdos like turning up at your house and stuff. So everybody had like, was assigned a box number, and then you ran an ad, they put your box number, and the people could send letters to your box, and then you go pick them up. So she starts doing that. And so she's going to go out on a date, first date since the divorce, and she wants something new and nice to wear. So she goes to this department store in the high street in this town, which is called Thames Valley on Thames, which I thought was very funny. So like I said, if you're really an Anglophile and you're into British stuff, or if you are British, this will probably be much funnier to you than it is to an American. But it's because a lot of the jokes are like real subtle and low key like that. And a lot of them have to do with particularly British things or like British culture. So if you don't know a lot about that, then some of the jokes might not be funny to you, because they are like pretty subtle. But just, I don't know, stuff like that like amused the shit out of me. So she lives in this town. There's this department store called Dentley and Soapers. And this department store has the world's weirdest commercials. They're like these really weird, you know, if you've ever watched like those kind of like new retro wave kind of channels, or like if you've seen like some of Dan Bell's stuff where he does like that real weird, like he takes shit from like infomercials and stuff and does this weird, it's a very vapor wavy type of situation. So it's these commercials, and they're all kind of like these creepy spinning mannequins, and it's all like this weird music. And then they have like all these saleswomen who are wearing what looks like Victorian morning clothes. I'm talking about the whole full on, like the big fucking skirts with the hoops and all this like lace and everything. And they all have like this real big hair. They have these bouffants or like big death rock things kind of going on. It's crazy. So they're like, in the ads and they're like luring everything. They have these big bright red nails and they're like luring people into the store. It's just like the weirdest thing you've ever seen. And so she goes to this department store. And she is kind of like looking around, and then she starts getting stalked by this sales lady who's like the main sales lady, Miss Luckmore. Now, Miss Luckmore, again, has this big, huge, like black bouffant, and she's like this big, like black Victorian dress. And she says like all this really weird shit. Like, I can't even remember. She has like all this like retail patter, but she says it in like this really verbose Baroque kind of language, and it's kind of like a running gag, I want to say, but it's just kind of like the shit that she says is just fucking crazy. And it's crazy too, because she says these really like poetic, like I said, really verbose type of things, and everybody else acts like Sheila, who's acts like a normal person, she reacts to that like it's kind of normal, you know what I mean? So which makes it funnier to me. But there's just like all this really weird shit in this store. Like when you buy something, you're waiting for your change. Like she has to put the money, you give her the money, she puts the money in this little tiny little cylinder thing, like at a bank that goes up the pipe, you know? And she puts it in there, and it goes up, and then while she's waiting for your change to come back down the pipe, she just stares at you, and you stare at her. And it's just like, and it's almost like this really weird, like long, like hypnosis type of thing going on. It's like so fucking weird. Okay, so Sheila goes to this store, and she sees this dress, and she gets talked into buying it. Now, this dress is, like, red, like, really red, and the catalog says artery red, which I love. It's this silk wrap dress, and it's kind of, again, kind of like this movie, it's not any particular style, you know what I'm saying? It's kind of old-fashioned, but not really. Like, maybe you could still kind of wear it. It's very, like, vague as to when it's, when it kind of came from, when it was in fashion. So it's this bright red dress. It's got kind of these long, sort of, like, puffy chiffon-type sleeves. It's made of silk. And its only kind of embellishment is it has, like, this black rose or something like that, like, on one hip. And on the inside of the seam, there's something stitched in Latin, and it means something like, "You who wear me will know me," or something like that. It says, like, on the inside. So Sheila gets talked into buying this dress, even though it's not something she would usually wear, because she seems, as I said, she seems very, like, modest, very dowdy, and this is, like, a bright red dress, and it's a little bit low cut, and she's talking about, isn't it a little, you know, risque, and things like that. And so, but she gets talked into buying it. And the sales lady is like, "Oh, this date that you're going on tonight, you know, he will compliment you," and all sorts of, in the weird fucking way that they talk. I don't want to spoil it too much because, like, this movie is so fucking weird. And it's like, if you're really, really into really bizarro shit, and like I said, if you liked Barbarian Sound Studio, you like these kind of, like, weird, surreal, like, homages to, like, old kind of, like, European type films, like, from the 60s and 70s, then you'll probably really dig this. Don't expect it to make total sense, because it doesn't. It does have a lot of dreamlike kind of shit, a lot of weird, like, Freudian kind of symbolism and stuff that isn't really explained. So know that going into it. It does have a narrative, it does have a story, but there's a lot of other little weird shit going on around the margins that doesn't really make any sense or isn't really explained, but that's kind of what made me love this movie, you know. So I'm just telling you that going in. So she wears this dress to the first date, and the first guy, whose name is Adonis, is a real fucking prize, by which I mean he's totally not. So yeah, so that doesn't really go all that well. So after that, though, pretty much immediately, she starts to suspect that something is wrong with this dress. Like, it's nothing real overt at first, but she starts kind of maybe hearing, you know, the hangers, like, kind of jingling weirdly, like, in her wardrobe. Sometimes the dress is, like, on the floor in her son's room, even though he insists that him and his girlfriend didn't touch it. So it's kind of, like, seems like it's moving around on its own. And then kind of a big thing happens where she puts it in the washing machine, like, to wash it, and pretty much it tears the entire washing machine, but, like, the washing machine just starts shaking, that it just basically, like, falls to pieces, and, like, all this, like, blood and shit comes out the bottom, or she actually ends up cutting her arm, like, while she's trying to stop the washing machine from doing all this stuff. So she starts to think something is the matter. Now, wearing the dress, she does actually go on a second date, and ends up meeting a guy named Zach, and they kind of fall into a relationship. Interestingly, fun fact, Zach is played by Barry Adamson, who's actually better known as a musician, and he was in Magazine, he was in The Birthday Party, he was in he's Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, and he also did a really awesome album, probably, gosh, I want to say it was back in the early 2000s, maybe late 90s, called Oedipus Schmedipus, which is actually, like, a really good album, but I didn't actually know that he did any acting, but I saw his name in the credits, and I was like, Barry, I was like, that Barry Adamson? Like, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, Barry Adamson, and indeed it is. So I thought that was kind of cool. But yeah, he's not a major part, but he is in it. So he's playing Sheila's, you know, new love interest. So again, you know, I think what kind of tips it is that she's out walking with Zach and she's wearing the dress and she randomly gets attacked by a dog. Like, it kind of, like, jumps at her and tries to, like, rip the dress off her. And then her son, like, finds the dress later and it's magically kind of restored itself. So at that point, she's like, yeah, fuck this. There's something really the matter with this dress. So she tries to take it back to the store, but they won't take it. It's like this big, huge rigmarole. I forgot to mention, too, that what you don't see is, like, Sheila's kind of life with her dress and her suspecting that, like, there's some weird shit going on with it. They're also showing you some weird shit that's going on in this department store behind the scenes. So you're kind of led to believe, I've seen this called Suspiria in a Department Store, which I totally get that. It does have a very Suspiria-esque vibe to it, in the sense that all the sales ladies that work there are kind of like a coven of witches, sort of. They don't overtly say that, but they all dress alike. They all have these weird, like they're trying to, like, hypnotize you or put a spell on you or something like that, and, like, the way they talk. And also, there's the guy that you're presuming is the manager or the owner of the store, who's this creepy-looking fucking dude who you could say is maybe he's the devil or something like that. Maybe these are all kind of, like I said, it's not overt, but you can read into it if you want to. But there's all this weird shit going on where there's, you know, there's this one really weird scene where Miss Luckmore, like the main lady, she goes back behind the scenes and like takes off her bouffant. So she's like bald. And then she kind of like curls herself up and puts herself into this like elevator dumbwaiter thing. And there's also this weird shit with, like, the mannequins, and it's almost kind of, like, suggested that maybe are they bringing the mannequins to life? Because there's just one super, super bizarro scene where her and one of the other sales ladies, they get this mannequin, and they lay her down on the floor, and she just has kind of, like black lingerie on or something. And then they start, like one of the sales ladies like sits on the mannequin's face that she's like caressing her boobs or whatever, and then they start like caressing like her crotch, and then like they pull like the underwear off, and then she has pubic hair, and then like the mannequin's like vagina starts to bleed, and then like the old guy that runs the store is like watching and like jerking it. It's like, it's super weird. There's, like I said, there's a lot of really Freudian, like, fetishistic. It's a very fetishistic movie, and I kind of feel like maybe that's, again, what he says. I read an interview with Peter Strickland where he was talking about this movie, and he said one of the ideas, he said, I remember when I was a kid and there was this one department store, I think it's called Jackson's, I don't think it's there anymore, where he grew up. I think he grew up in Reading. And so he said, I remember being dragged there by my mom, and these department stores being these kind of like, you know, like these wonderful magical places, but also something kind of sinister about them. And he said, and I was also really interested in the concept of like secondhand stores, like secondhand clothing. And he's like, I always found it really interesting that you're buying these clothes and you don't know who had them before. Like they could be dead. And, you know, it's like, and you don't know them, but like you can still like smell them, like with their BO on it and stuff, which is a very intimate kind of thing for somebody that you don't know. So that, again, like our kind of like fetishistic relationship with clothing. And also it's kind of satirical, I guess, because he's talking about kind of like a satire of like consumerism, because there definitely is some shit with like the people, because this is set actually during the January sales, which is not a thing in the US, but I know it's like a big thing in the UK, like after Christmas, like everybody wants to buy everything. I guess it's kind of more like equivalent to in the US, like the day after Thanksgiving, which is Black Friday, which is when everybody does all their Christmas shopping because everything's super, super cheap. So it's kind of the same situation in the UK, but it's after Christmas, and so it's January sales. So that's when this is set. During the January sales. So he's kind of like making a joke about, you know, all these people come to this department store and they're all just like hopping up and down, like waiting to get in. And then like all the weird witch ladies are like, you know, telling everybody they can come in. And then it's crazy. And it's totally weird. And then like at the end, which I won't spoil, there's also another thing that's kind of like reminds me of some Black Friday shit as well. And it was like meant to. But yeah, so it is a satire of like, you know, unfettered consumerism, I guess. And it's also kind of making points about, again, the fetishism of clothing and how going to a department store and buying like new clothes, it's almost kind of like it's going to solve all your problems type of thing, like new you, all this stuff. So it's kind of like, you know, making a little bit of a sly poke at that type of, you know, concept as well. So yeah. Oh, I forgot to mention too, that one of the things that that gets Sheila upset about the dress is that she finds out that there was only one of these dresses, and the woman that wore it in the catalog, because she sees it in the catalog, died. Like, she got run over by a car or something like that. And so you're kind of, like, led to believe this dress is cursed, obviously. So about the halfway point of the movie, which is a little bit jarring, and if I had to have any, like, very minor criticism of the movie, this the only criticism I would have is that the second half of the movie, where the dress goes on to another person, those characters are not quite as compelling as Sheila was. I think it was like actually a little bit more than halfway, because Sheila's thing was most, it's not a hugely long movie. I think it's only like an hour and 45 minutes. But her story is kind of like, you know, a little more than half. And then after, like at the halfway point, the dress ends up in a secondhand shop. It gets bought by this guy who buys it as a gag for a friend of his who is having a bachelor party. And they make him wear it. And then it kind of gets passed on to that guy's fiance. And, you know, the same shit starts to happen to them. Like, you get a rash, and the, like I said, the dress kind of, like, moves around on its own. Like, there's a couple great shots of, like, people sleeping, and the dress is just kind of, like, hanging, like, in the air above them. And it does actually try to, like, suffocate a couple people. It suffocates, like, it kills a little canary or bird or whatever. It does that kind of stuff. Now, again, I don't want to spoil too much about this because it's not that old, and I really think if you're really into, like, weird-ass, like, surrealist cinema and you really like, you know, old European films, like, really weird shit like that, then you would probably really like this, and I don't want to spoil too much of what happens. Like I said, it does have a plot. It is about the dress and it being cursed, but it has, like, so much other. It's just, like, rich with all this weird, like, symbolic detail, and like I said, you can kind of read it in lots and lots of different ways, which is one thing that's really awesome about it. And like I said, this is definitely one that I'm gonna do, like, a second rewatch on. But yeah, there's just so much weird ass goodness in this movie. Like, the sound design is so awesome, like, the score is really awesome, the visuals are just so striking. It's just a bizarre, bizarre flick. Like I said, if you're into giallo stuff, if you're into anything like that that has that sort of sensibility to it, then you probably really, really like this. Like I said, it has a very British thing too, like almost like a weird ass Hammer film, but filtered through giallo and filtered through maybe like surrealist kind of, like I said, like a Ken Russell or something like that. It's just like, it's so, so hard to describe. And the humor is really hard to describe, too. Some of the funniest shit in it is just random. Like I said, the two guys that that run the bank, and they're kind of in the second part, too, because it turns out that they know the second guy, Reg, who gets hold of the dress, because it's his bachelor party. And he goes there for a loan and, like, talks to them. And just, like, the weird shit that they say is just, I can't even explain it. So that is, like, hilarious. All of the fucking, you know, the sales girl, like, sales lady, like, Miss Luckmore, like, all the bizarre-ass Baroque shit she says, and, like, the whole, I just love how they talk like that in the store, like, they're talking to the customers, and everyone's just acting like it's normal. It's just, like, I don't know, that was, like, really funny to me. But there's just, like, so many little touches like that, and just so much bizarre. There's, like, all this weird shit about dreams. Like, a lot of people, like, relating their dreams to other people, and then they, like, show you the dream. Like, one girl has a dream that she's like, I dreamed I was looking through the catalog in the department store, and every picture was of me, but then as it went on, like, the dress sizes got bigger and bigger, and I got thinner and thinner, and then, you know, I died and got buried in the store, like, in this big elaborate coffin. And then, like, her fiancé has a dream that he's, like, watching her give birth, and then, like, the baby comes out, like, with a little bitty version of that red dress on, and he's, like, flicking the dude off. It's just the weirdest fucking shit. And it's just, like, it has just bizarre, grotesque kind of, like, sensibility to it, and I love it. It was just so, I don't know. This, like I said, this movie is just, like, so in my wheelhouse. It's almost like it was made specifically for me. And it's just, like, because I didn't know, like, anybody else would be that into it. Because I was like, this is exactly, has all, every single thing that I like is in this fucking movie. And so I was just, like, I was just, like, riveted by this movie the whole time. And like I said, I'd love to see it a second time because it was just, it's so great. And I just really loved, like, the imagery of it. I just loved everything about it. As I said, the only criticism is that when you get to the second part, like, when the dress goes on to the next person, like, Reg and Babs, who is his fiance, when it passes on to them and some of the same shit starts to happen, it's, you know, it's still good, but it's just those characters aren't quite as compelling as Sheila was, like, in the first part. So, but that's the only thing. And really, it's not really that much of an issue because there was some funny shit going on with that, too. Because, like I said, Reg, he's a washing machine repairman, and they have this, and it happens, like, a couple times, like, a gag in there that he's, like, looking at people's washing machines and explaining, like, what could be wrong with them and how he's gonna fix it, and he's like talking like in all this like, you know, washing machine jargon, and it's like really boring, but it's kind of like every time he does that, the person that he's talking to like starts going into this weird like orgasmic type of reverie, like it's the sexiest thing they've ever heard, and it's just like, and it sounds like goofier than it is. It's like when you see it in the movie, it's just like, it's like really bizarre. It's like hard to explain. I was reading some different kind of interpretations of this film. Most of them settle on something like, you know, the department store is kind of like run by this coven, you know, essentially is what it is. And they're kind of like throwing a glamour on people, like trying to suck people in there and getting their souls that they end up like making the dresses out of. And they control the dress, which seems pretty obvious from some of the scenes that are in there, because sometimes you'll have like one of the sales ladies like doing some kind of witchy movements, and then like the dress is somewhere else like doing some shit too. So they're controlling the dress by some means. But another interpretation that I saw that I actually like a lot, I can't even remember what site that I saw this on, but one person said it's actually funnier and cooler if you see this movie from the dress's point of view. Like, if you imagine that the dress is like a serial killer and it's going about its life like doing different victims, because they said, honestly, and this was something that I was kind of interested in with the film too, honestly, when Sheila buys the dress to wear on her date, the dress doesn't do anything bad to her right away. So I'm kind of suspecting that if you respect the dress, then maybe the dress won't fuck you up. Because she honestly doesn't start getting, like, the dress doesn't start fucking with her until she starts to suspect there's something the matter with it and starts, like, trying to give it away or exchange it or something like that. So it's almost kind of like, well, she disrespected it, so now it's going to, like, start. It was fucking with other people, but it was fucking with other people that she didn't like. You know what I mean? It was kind of fucking with, like, her son's girlfriend who was kind of a dick and, you know, who was kind of an asshole to her. So it did try to, like, kill that girl and stuff, but it didn't try to do anything to Sheila until Sheila, like, got scared of it and, like, tried to give it away. And I think that when it passed on to Reg, he ended up getting it because the dude bought it for him, like, as a joke, because they were having, like, a bachelor party, and they made him wear it. So, again, you know, the dress is being disrespected, so the dress is gonna, like, retaliate, I guess. And I hadn't thought of it that way, but I was kind of like, oh man, that's like actually a really good way of looking at it. Like, because the dress does appear to be like sentient to some degree. It knows what's going on. And so it stands to reason that, you know, if you, you know, bought the dress and you loved it and wore it, and maybe it would do nice things for you, because they do kind of imply that when Sheila first buys it, you know, that this is going to make your date go really well, which it didn't. But I do kind of feel like, if you, you know, respected the dress, then it would magically help you. But if you disrespected the dress, then it would start to, like, fuck with you. I don't know. But I do kind of feel like that was maybe implied in the story. I don't know. If you've seen it, like, let me know what you think it is. But I really do like that interpretation, seeing everything from the dress's point of view rather than the human character's point of view. Because, like I said, it's almost kind of like, it almost is kind of like an anthology movie in the sense that it's two stories or, like, two sets of characters, but they kind of, like, interact with each other. And they're both, like, you know, because it's set in the same time frame. Like I said, the bank that Sheila worked at, you know, Reg loses his job and he goes to that same bank, like the two bank managers later, to get a loan, stuff like that. So, and you know, there is one part where when Reg and Babs, you know, she's wrapping something, like Babs is wrapping something up in newspaper, and there's a thing like about what happened to Sheila in the paper. So, you know, they do intertwine, but it's almost kind of like two sort of separate stories with like some threads in common. So, you know, so know that going in, it's almost kind of like a little, like a mini anthology kind of. Like I said, it's supposed to be kind of an homage to Amicus Hammer type of stuff, but in a more surrealist Eurotrash kind of way. But yeah, so, I mean, if that sounds anything like something that you would dig, then please check it out. I watch it on Amazon Prime. It's not free. You have to pay $3.99 to rent it, but totally worth it. And like I said, I'm totally really going to watch this a second time because I really, really liked it the first time. And I'm definitely going to watch Peter Strickland's second film, The Duke of Burgundy, which I heard is really good. And that's the one that I haven't seen. I have seen Barbarian Sound Studio, his first one, which came out in 2012. And I actually did a review of that one a while back, too. But yeah, I'm really getting into this dude's work. You know, let me know if you've seen this movie, if you've seen either of his other ones, and if they're worth watching, particularly Duke of Burgundy, because I haven't seen that one. And yeah, so let me know what you thought about this if you saw it. And that will do it for this Flickers of Fear. I will see you guys on the next one. Bye.